Gilles Stockton operates a family cattle and sheep ranch. He comes to us from Montana. Like some other people, he is pursuing his craft with the benefit of advanced degree, in his case a master's degree in animal science from Montana State University, and has been a leader in the Western Organization of Research Councils, among other efforts. And at the end there, I'm trying to see, here's that Clem Ward. For those who don't know, Clem is one of the leaders in agricultural economics. He is at Oklahoma State University. I think, are you emeritus now? Or is it like he was there for a long career, 31 years, focusing on the broad changes in the industry. We're so glad to have you here with us today. Sitting next on my right here, Mark Lauritsen, is that right? Mark Lauritsen represents a number of the folks here in yellow shirts, you can see. Those who work in sort of the other side of the business, helping to pack the beef. There are a lot of workers employed in that, has a valuable perspective to offer from the United Food and commercial workers. Mark Greenwood, another perspective from the AgStar Financial Services, lending to ranchers. We appreciate you joining us, Mark. Mark comes to us from Montana, is that right?
Mankato.
What's that?
Mankato.
Mankato. All right, great. And Armando Valdez is another producer who joins us on this panel. He is also from Colorado, doing a family farm with cows and calves. We appreciate you coming to us, I should say, for those here. Armando is a graduate of Colorado State University.
Absolutely. You got to play to the crowd, right?
That's right. Absolutely. And, we appreciate you joining us. Bill Heffernan is, like Clem, one of the giants in the academy. He got a PhD in rural sociology and has been for quite some time at the University of Missouri. It's great to have you here with us, Bill. Thanks for joining us. So as I said, I want to start off with the broadest picture. There is, as has been discussed, increasing concentration in cattle and hog industries. I guess from the two academics who bookend us, let me ask you for your perspectives. Clem, how would you describe the situation as it's evolved?
Okay. First of all, I think we all know that what's happened in the packing industry and retailing industry is not unique to our economy. It's pretty much happened throughout most of a lot of manufacturing industries and other sectors of the economy. Concentration's increase has come about and typically comes about from two sources. One's internal growth of the firms themselves, and the other is through mergers and consolidation. And we've seen a lot of both of those things in the pork beef packing industries and in the retail industry. I'm more familiar with the packing industry, so I'll pretty much concentrate on that. But back in the 70s, four-firm concentration of the four largest firms had about 25-27% of the market share, and in the hog industry, it was about 32-33%. Then through the 80s, we had some very, very sharp market structure changes. We had a number of plants that were not profitable who closed their doors. Some of those were purchased by other packers. Some were closed for a time, came back with different labor contracts. Some of them were expanded. But the driving force at that time was to try to become more efficient. And so there had been a couple studies at that time, and there have been some since then, all of which suggest there are significant economies of size in the packing business. So the larger you are, the lower your average costs are, and that was the driving force. Along the way, we had some mergers and acquisitions that that were in conjunction with growing those plants, and some that may have just been because they thought there were some multi-plant economies that they wanted to achieve.
Clem, you said on the packing side there's some economies of scale of being bigger. How about on the ranching side? Are there economies of scale there too, or there have a smaller?
Some, but much lesser. Most of the research has been fairly consistent that there are some economies up to about 1,000 head cow herds, and then it may tail off pretty sharply.
So one of the suggestions we've heard, and let me actually turn the suggestion to Bill to analyze a little bit, is that greater level of concentration at the packers and stockyards level has actually tried to put pressure on ranchers to get bigger. Is that true, do you think?
Well, we've heard several times that they push essentially for the larger rancher in terms of giving them some preferential treatment and such. But I want to go back for just a moment, if I might, to the concentration. I got involved in looking at this concentration, and I borrowed from the economists back in the 1960s who were talking about what percent of the market share did the largest four firms have. And they their view at that point, and these were primarily institutional economists back in those days, that's people who, you know, will take a little bit from sociology or psych or political or science or whatever. They were sort of the Renaissance people. But they said when four firms had more than 40% of the market share, you begin to lose some of the benefits of competition. I sort of came along a little later, along about the late 60s, and I took sort of that and went back to what is called small group studies, some sociological theory that basically says that when you have four social units left sort of in a competitive market, and I'd like you to think about board games that families play and so on, because in a sense they did things like this in terms of their experiments. What they found was when you had like 9-10 players, that was really pretty competitive. But as you move back toward about four firms, what you found was they started acting in concert. They would look at one another, what move they made, and then they would adjust their behavior accordingly. Therefore, for instance, they would look to see what somebody else did, if they raised or lowered the price, whichever way it happened to be, and then they would do the same. So in a sense, what has happened is when we got down to that CR4, once it started moving over 40%, and most of them are well over 50, 60%, up around 75% or more, as you heard, when you have four firms operating in concert, I call it a near monopoly. And so that's one of the problems and why we concentrated early on the CR4. Second point I want to make, it's not just the concentration of the four firms. That's what we call, you know, basically the horizontal integration. It's the food chain that is now supply chain, the food supply chain that is lined up, so that basically you have maybe three or four dominant players starting all the way back with the seed or even the gene for that matter. And they control either through ownership or through what we call strategic alliance. That's joint ventures, long-term agreements, and so on, all the way from the seed down through the supermarket. I don't have time to give you an example, but that's another way. And in a sense, you end up, and I'm a member of board of directors of the Ozark Mountain Pork, which started about 8-10 years ago, trying to find a market for our what we call farmers of the middle. And we ran up to that problem. In a sense, you got to compete with the whole supply chain. How do you break into that? So all I'm saying is it's really hard to break into the system. The third thing I want to do is do a quick flip on that and say, but those big firms we've been talking about in the CR4, they're not immune to getting pushed out either, or thrown out as the case may be. And I think we need to keep that in mind. In a sense, it's sort of like they're running on a treadmill, and they got to run faster and faster. And if they stumble somewhere along the line, they're gone. And since I'm in Colorado, I'll use the Albertson model. They were third-rank retail firm about 5 years ago. What happened to them? Those of you in Colorado know. I've been through Denver and so on enough, looking at those old stores that didn't get picked up right away. What happened was Safeway, which is down in seventh place, teamed up with an investment firm, and basically it was a hostile takeover. That was a firm that was operating fine and dandy. You read the trade journals. They were doing a good job. And they woke up one morning, and that management team was history. Now, that really isn't a very efficient way to run things. And all we did was move Safeway up to third place, and the other one shifted up a little bit, and life went on.
So people are going to have questions, I suspect, as we go on. There should be volunteers in green shirts. If you want to write your question down and give it to one of them, get filtered up here. I'll see if I can intersperse them in. That gets us to the retail. And that obviously is another piece of this equation. Mark, maybe you can offer a few thoughts. How is retail and retail concentration more specifically impacting in the whole supply chain?
Well, at first, I think we need to look at this. I wanted to point something out from this morning before I answer that question. Attorney General Bullock described what's going on today as putting packers and producers in the same room was like establishing a firing squad in a circle. And it kind of got a chuckle out of the group. But then I got to thinking about it. I just got to make this comment. I have the honor and the pleasure of working for the union that represents the hardworking men and women that work in the slaughterhouses around this country, be it beef, pork, chicken, and all of food processing. And when you guys established that firing squad, we're the folks you put smack dab in the middle of it. Now, I say that, and I say this to my friends on the producer side, those 250,000 people that we represent, they need you in the supply chain. They need the producers to produce a good herd. To my friends on the packer side, those 250,000 people that we represent, we need you. You supply the jobs. So in this firing squad, you've put us in the middle. And we've kind of created this family fight. And we forgot to look at this whole system as a food chain or a supply chain. And if we try to adjust these problems by looking at them strictly from the packer back or from the producer forward to the packer, and we miss out the most important piece in that food supply chain, we're going to treat a symptom, but we're not going to get to the disease. And I'm talking about the retail side. There's been consolidation in the food supply chain. And it's going on right now, and it's going on rapidly in the retail sector. Right now, today, Walmart controls 23% of the grocery. Now, you may not think 23% doesn't seem like much, but think about what's been happening since the early 90s, when Walmart's growth in the grocery store sector has taken off and expanded. One in five retail dollars in America is spent at a Walmart store. Walmart controls 44%, or excuse me, 44% of the markets. Walmart controls over 30% of the grocery store dollars. Walmart has more retail stores than the next five closest competitors combined, and it does more grocery store sales than its next three biggest competitors. So what has all this caused over the last number of years when this concentration took place? Well, since 1990, if you look at the consumer dollar that was spent in beef, the retailer took 33 cents of that retail dollar. The rest of it was passed back through the supply chain. Today, in beef, the retailer keeps 49 cents. That's a dramatic increase. In 1990, in pork, the retailer kept 45 cents of that consumer dollar. Today, in pork, the retailer's keeping 61 cents. Now, here's the thing. The people that I represent, the cut that they get comes from what the packer keeps. That's been constant. It's been around anywhere, if it's beef or pork, from 8 to 14%. But it's been pretty constant during all this time. There's a way to address these needs. But again, I want to challenge everybody to let's face the problems we have and go at it from the total picture and looking at the retail. And here's really what we're talking about. I've talked to people from RCAF, and they would tell us that if one penny was passed back down through the supply chain from the retail side, that would make a dramatic increase in the farmer and the rancher's lives. One penny from the retailer. We've done our studies at the UFCW. One penny takes the average packing house worker's wage from $13.50 to $16. Those kind of numbers affect our communities. They improve our communities. So what are we talking about? 2 cents. 2 cents changes the lives of everybody in this room. My challenge to you and what I would say to everybody is, let's look at where that 2 cents lies. I think it lies up on the retail end, and it's the consolidation on the retail side that I believe is forcing consolidation all throughout the supply chain in the food industry.
So, Libby, you have firsthand experience in the retail sector. I guess I'd ask you to analyze those markets generally with what's been said and also specifically to whether these are local markets, national markets, or both. How would you explain to people who are trying to understand the retail side how things are evolving?
Well, it's interesting because I think no industry is more competitive than the supermarket industry, where we're looking at 2 to 3% net profit margin. So this issue with the small farmers and ranchers is reminds me of us back in the early supermarket days with wild oats markets trying to compete with the large supermarket chains like Safeway, Walmart's. And I think we did so effectively by creating a niche market and educating our consumers on local and organics. And I think that's an important lesson maybe for local farmers, small farmers and ranchers here today. I would take issue with the margins that Mark was talking about. Typically our margins in the meat and in part of our business are some of the lowest, more like 20% with a maximum of probably a 35% margin. And I think we are trying to not only promote but really help local vendors and manufacturers succeed. And we highlight them and really try to focus on helping that small farmer or rancher succeed. And I know, for example, Whole Foods now, after the acquisition of Wild Oats, works with, for example, Panorama Beef, organic and natural beef supplier up in Wyoming that's raises their cattle on Indian lands. And so they just recently started working with this producer about a year ago. So, I think we are in the natural foods industry always looking to help promote the alternative, smaller, more high-quality rancher that's producing a high-quality product.
So I want to go, if we can, I think, Armando, you would fit in this category, producing a high-quality product. Have you had success working with retail outfits like Whole Foods? What's your experience been?
Experience working with some of these retailers, especially organic natural markets. If you're a smaller rancher producer, it's much more difficult. Unless you come with 200 head, they don't even want to talk to you. So you try to look for other options and other retailers who share your values, especially as a small rancher or producer, and producing that product and who want to work with you. But if they don't share those values, it's about some of those efficiencies, economies of scale. They want that product in bulk, as many as they can get. And if you're not that size, then there aren't that many options available. We've tried to market to Whole Foods in the past, and they told us we just don't have the numbers. And I don't consider myself a small producer. We have 300 head of cattle, and they still wanted more. So we've looked at marketing through other co-ops, to where in the earlier panel this morning, looking at bringing different ranchers and families together, we could finish our own cattle and sell direct to the consumers. So that's another option that's out there. In our discussion today, though, we keep talking about change, moving forward, what are we going to do for the future? But it's almost like we're going back in time. Think about the 1920, 1921, when the original Packers and Stockyards Act was coming out. They're probably having conversations dealing around some of these same issues with packer concentration. And there may be, because ranchers and farmers are never able to retire, there may be a few still around who remember what was happening in those days and could actually give some testimony from then. But they were successful in creating more competition, reducing some of that concentration in the market. And look what happened, as one of the gentlemen earlier in the testimony mentioned. 1980, we started seeing deregulation, and here we came back with increased concentration. I do agree with Dr. Ward down at the end about the economies of scale and the efficiencies. There are significant efficiencies, I think, when you do have the consolidation as well as vertical integration. But efficiency is only one part of that equation. What happens with your economic power and what happens with economic freedom? We talked about some of those freedoms this morning as an individual producer, being able to take my product, find competitive bids, make profitable margins with my product. If we're focusing just on efficiency, and consolidation is really taking economic power and putting it one place, what am I left with? And then I'm not left with much economic freedom.
So I want to go to Jerry and introduce someone who we've not talked a lot about today, which is the consumer, and how the consumer fits into this equation. Some have posited that the consumer have focused on getting cheap food, and that demand for cheap food has kind of reverberated through the system. Is that a suggestion you find merit in, or do you have other explanations of how the consumers are approaching their food?
I think that in our country, I believe that our government has a cheap food policy. I think that they want to keep food cheap so that the majority of the people, the 97% who are not in agriculture, are able to produce food at a low price. I think consumers, though, have become more discriminating, and there are opportunities in the markets today. We found by our involvement with U.S. Premium Beef that beef consumers are willing to pay a higher price for a higher quality product and a more consistent product. And so the system that we're involved in, and it would be similar to several other systems that are involved, that other producers are involved in, focus on producing a higher quality product that's consistently good every time they eat it. And to do that, we have to do some things differently than we've done in the past. And I want to speak briefly here for a minute. We're all here today because we don't think we're getting enough for our product. Nobody's talked about how we to build demand to sell more beef at a higher price. We're all worried about packer concentration. They're cheating us. And we haven't heard a word about growing demand and building demand. Why in the world would we not do that? Let's get Japan open 100%. Let's get China open 100%. Let's grow demand. All of you will benefit if you sell more beef at a higher price. That's what you're here for. Government entities also tell people they shouldn't eat beef. Look at the food pyramid. Don't eat meat. It's at the point of the pyramid. Help us sell beef. I think that's what government can do. Instead of here telling us how to sell our cattle and how to market them, let's sell beef. Let's increase demand. The consumer's there. They want our product, but we've got to provide it for them.
Gilles, what's your... What's your perspective on what consumers want and how to achieve the sort of premium opportunity that I think both Libby and Jerry have mentioned?
Growing demand, huh? Sell more to Japan, sell more to China. We can't raise enough to feed the people in this country. And the reason we can't raise enough to feed the people in this country is that the people who do the hard work out in the land and the people who work in the slaughter plants are not getting their fair share of that consumer dollar, retail dollar. I don't need JBS or Tyson to tell me how to raise good cattle. I raise good cattle. I raise the best cattle. I've retained ownership. They fed in the top 10% of, the nation. And there's nothing special about, me. I'm not smarter than my neighbors. They know how to raise cattle. They know how to raise cattle better than I do. So we don't need a top-down corporate board of directors telling us what to do. I got concerned about this this issue in 1987 when a poultry producer came out to Montana and he talked to us. And he told us what happened to him in the poultry industry. And he begged us, he said, don't become like me. Don't become a serf on my own land. And I don't want to be a serf on my own land. I want to be independent. But I think independent farmers and ranchers selling in a competitive market can compete with anybody of any size, whether they're small producers, 1,000 head cattle producers, 100,000 head feedlotters. There is very little in the economy of scale, and we can compete if we have a fair market. Now, the cow-calf section of agriculture is a little bit unique in that it is the only part of agriculture that still markets through an auction system. And in recent years, we've been marketing more and more through a video internet auction systems. And they work very well. They're a very inexpensive way to, market our cattle. And we market them through forward contracts. Now, if you can make a forward contract for fall delivery of feeder calves, you sure as hell can make a forward contract for, two or three-week delivery of fat cattle. There's no big trick here. All we need to do in order to restore competition in the cattle industry is require that the beef packers buy out in the open, in a public.
So, Gilles, you've anticipated my next question. I will turn to Clem and ask it, which is, how are the markets for the buying, be it spot market, exchanges, forward contracting, evolving, and how do you analyze their current sort of dynamics?
Okay. And I think we've talked about some of this. Let me mention, and I guess I'll do it. In 1993, I think, on the hog side, 87% of the hogs sold were from the cash market. We've said many times last year that averaged 6%. Now some weeks it may be down below 5%. On the cattle side, in the late 1990s, we were at about 60% or so in the cash market. Last year, on average, it was about 35%. So we have had an increase in other kinds of marketing arrangements, the so-called AMAs. There's been some people obviously not very happy with a formula price to the cash market. I know myself and other economists have said for a long time that people who are formula pricing ought to try to be looking up at the wholesale level, something that a packer would try to push up as high as possible rather than tying that price to a price that a packer would try to push down as much as possible. But there's problems in doing that. There are a few people who are both in the hog industry and the beef industry trying to formula price to the wholesale market. There's been an increase on both in hogs and cattle in the last 10 years in forward contracting where you're pricing to basically the futures market, as somebody alluded to in the open mic session this morning. So people are looking for other alternatives, and as we get thin markets, as I think will probably be mentioned later, some people are voluntarily trying to support that market by marketing a part of their hogs or cattle through the cash trade and part through contracts.
Armando, you are having to face this question on a regular basis. How do you go about marketing your cattle?
You're trying to look for as many options as possible for the best price. It comes down to profitability and looking for the option which gives you that biggest margin or greatest margin out there. I've done or worked through several different marketing options all the way from the spot market and cash markets, trying to inform buyers there at those markets, the quality of the cattle, some premiums such as the natural aspects that we keep with our cattle, also looking at forward contracting and other contracting markets, and it's difficult. And I don't know if it's the region of where I'm at in South Central Colorado. We're a little more isolated. We do have to ship those cattle a lot further away than someone who has, a feeder right down the road. I don't have one probably within, 150 miles. And so I'm trying to see how I get those cattle out at the best price. And so it is a challenge finding options a lot of times. And it's a lot more work on my part. There was a gentleman this morning on the panel who mentioned, we're out there trying to ranch, farm, produce the best quality product, and then we're being asked to market it, and then we're asked to make these changes of what the buyers want, and it's constantly more pressure being put on a producer. It's like kicking a man when he's down.
I want to, before I come back to this, I want to put another piece of this equation on the table, which is the credit side that Mark deals with. One suggestion we've heard is that part of the push towards the forward contracting or captive suppliers, as some have called it, is they need to have those contracts to get credit. Mark, how do you analyze that issue?
You know, I kind of feel like the coal cow here, or the coal pig, being a lender, and I don't know if I was the only one crazy enough to be on a panel with this many producers.
I think Libby feels that way having a retail on the panel,
yeah,
too.
So Libby, we should have sat by each other. My first thing is I work almost exclusively in the swine sector. There's not a lot of cattle in Minnesota, so my knowledge base is much more on the swine side. When we look at marketing agreements in order to get access to capital, it has been a driver in order to get access to capital as we've went through it. If you kind of look at the volatility in the marketplace that we've seen over the last 13 years, just to even look over the last 12 months, we went from, I think a producer talked about $105 a pig last August to where today we're making $160. Now, most of the marketing agreements per se, the other thing I would say as a lender, we continually learn, and I think we have to learn kind of through history. The thing that I talk about with our producers is, we have a relationship with our producers. We work very, very hard on making sure that we try to make our producers profitable at the end of the day. Because if they go out of business, that's not good for us by any means. So we want a viable industry going forward. So part of the things that we talk about with marketing agreements, they are pretty much shackle space, where you have an alignment with the packer that gives you the option to deliver those pigs. The issue today, when we have a less supply because of one of the plants that got closed in Sioux City, because we have less supply, August of last year, I had producers that were selling on the open market that could not sell pigs for 3 weeks, and that was a problem. So, as a lender, and I'll give you kind of how my job works, I'm not the person that makes the decision when we do the yay or the nay on the credit. I'm the relationship manager that goes to his farm, tries to understand his business best he can, and then we kind of work together on trying to develop a business plan that works best for his business. I have to go in front of a credit committee and kind of explain this to our credit committee, and part of the things that they're going to ask is what type of alignment or what type of market agreements do they have in place to ensure that mitigate some of that risk. If you're a younger producer, which the other comment I'd make is in Minnesota and the Midwest, we do have young producers that are very successful today raising hogs. We've been able to do that. And we've worked together in developing marketing plans. We do extensive training on risk management using futures and options. We might do forward contracts with a packer, but it's using all the toolbox in the toolboxes to make sure that producer has a chance at being profitable. Now, part of that is the issue is if a young producer that's 25 comes to me and says he's going to sell all his pigs on the open market, I might have high integrity that he has the management capabilities to be able to do that. But the question that I'm going to get asked is, what risk management tools is he going to use? Is he going to be able to use futures? Is he going to have a place to deliver his pigs? Those are the questions that I get asked. So, I do think when I look at the 5% of the spot market today, it is a little bit thin. But again, where I'm at, I prefer not the government to decide what that is. I trust my producers in making those decisions for
them. I'm going to go to Jerry with the broader question is, do the current institutions in the market provide sufficient price discovery opportunity and transparency? Is that something that you're comfortable with? Obviously, some people have suggested that there may be flaws in the current system. What's your view?
Okay, I can speak for our company. We have at least three buyers every week, sometimes four. We sell about 60% of our cattle. We market about 175,200 head of fed cattle a year. About 60% of our cattle are merchandised in the cash market, and about 40% are on grids or possibly forward contract, those kinds of things. So we see, and I think the Texas Panhandle, Kansas markets, Nebraska, Colorado are all fairly competitive in that regard. And I want to back up a little bit and speak for a minute about marketing opportunities. You know, one of the things we're talking here today are the fact that small producers don't have a chance to participate in these marketing systems that we have today. I want to share a little data with you from U.S. Premium Beef first, and then I want to share a personal one with you from our company. U.S. Premium Beef has marketed about 8 million head, had about 8 million head of cattle delivered through in its system since it started in 1996. The average premium per head for every one of those animals was $21.74 per head, above the cash market. But we found that the smaller producers get an even bigger price, bigger premium. 82% of our members deliver less than 500 cattle a year. I think they would be considered small producers. In our sort there, the top 25% premiums that were paid in the, with the company, the top premium went to the group made up of members that deliver less than 250 head a year. They got $63.48 a head premium. If you look at the top 10% of the premiums, the members that delivered less than 250 head of cattle per year got $79.74 a head premium. The second highest group were those that delivered under 100 head a year. I would consider them small producers also. They got $79.57 a head premium. So there are opportunities today in the market systems that are existing today for small producers to participate. Let me share a personal one with you. I had a man this spring, a customer from Kentucky. He had 18 head of cattle in our feed yard. He was part of a multi-owner pen. He had grouped with some of his neighbors to send a pen of cattle to our feed yard. When we merchandised his cattle, he got $129 a head premium for those 18 steers. Now, if he'd have took them to the auction market or if he'd have sold them in the cash market where everybody gets the same price for the same cattle, he wouldn't have gotten that premium. So I'm telling you, there are opportunities for each one of you to participate in the market today and to get a higher price for your cattle.
I'm going to come back to that point in a minute. First, a little bit more discussion about sort of the price discovery and transparency. Mark, you want to?
Just 30 seconds. If I look at our portfolio over the last 2 years when we saw corn go from almost up to $8 to now we're sitting at about $4, the independent producer that raised most of his own corn compared to the larger producers that had to buy a lot of their own feedstuffs have much better fared financially. And we look at the portfolio. They have fared much better financially than the larger producers. So it goes back to Jerry's point. An independent producer, if you have market opportunities, can compete with anybody. And actually, when I look at in the Midwest, from a global perspective, U.S. pork production is the best in the world.
So let me go to, we have two producers, ask you from your perspectives, have you been able to get enough insight into the price system so that you feel you're able to know where and how to sell, or do you feel like there are some sorts of structural limitations? Armando?
From my perspective, I don't think the information sharing is there. I don't know if the transparency is there, because if all those premiums were available, I don't think this room would be full with all these different individuals out here. I think there is preferential agreements. I think if you're fit within a certain characteristic or fit into a certain box or a certain area, I think there are those premiums available. Being an individual, like I said, with distance as an obstacle, I know I'm getting discounted automatically, and that becomes a challenge. And I know there's other ranchers and producers out here who feel and share those same experiences, especially in my area.
Gilles, what's your experience been?
Well, you know, it's a little bit complicated because we've got two sides to the cattle industry. And I'm a cow-calf, and I'm not really dealing directly with any packers. And I never, although I did last year, I got one bid, was take it or leave it. And I took it. A week later, the market started going up. And for no reason. For no reason whatsoever. You know? And if you look at the market for the cattle in the last 3 years, it's been going up and down. Demand is constant. Demand is pretty good, even with the recession. Numbers are down. The market's going up. Market's going down. You know, your USDA, Gypsy, you tell me why, because It makes no sense to me. There's something I wanted to kind of just finish from my previous talk there. In 1996, the Western Organization Resource Council gave USDA a petition for rulemaking. And there were hearings held in Denver in 2000. Very extensive hearings, and some of these same people were there, and I think quite a few of the people here. Lose my page. Where'd it go?
We can come back to this.
No, I just finished. So we had those hearings, and there was never a ruling from USDA. And the subsequent secretaries of agriculture have not ever made a ruling. I'm submitting today, you know, a letter, and if you can give this to Secretary Vilsack and Attorney General Holder, asking to look at this rule, this competitive and transparent pricing rule. It's a very, very simple rule. All it says is that beef packers should make their forward formula contracts in an open public manner, bid with a base price. And the second part of the rule says that if packers are feeding livestock, those livestock should be marketed in an open public manner. There should be a firewall between their packing subsidiaries and their feeding subsidiaries. I'm just saying, let's take what's being done under the table and in the dark and just bring it out in the sunshine.
Clem, how do you analyze the price discovery issue?
When we talk about price discovery, when we talk about concentration, both, there's an aspect here that I think has been alluded to, but we've never really openly addressed it, and that's the fact that, you know, if you're situated in the heart of hog production country, or you're situated in the heart of cattle feeding, you know, the concerns that you may have about price discovery and concentration are probably going to be less than you're out in some of those other areas, what I would call the fringe production areas, where you may be more adversely affected. There are regional differences. The RTI study found regional differences in the amount of AMA use by packers by region, both in hogs and in cattle. But we also know that as concentration increased and we began to close plants and so on, it was usually in those areas where there were not a lot of supplies nearby. And those are a lot of the areas where many of you are from and have major concerns about not having opportunities because those plants are no longer there. I just thought it should be mentioned that, you know, there are some regional concerns here associated with price discovery and concentration.
So the other question I want to put on the table is respect to something which has been talked about but worth talking about expressly, that there's opportunity for premium products or in niche areas. People seem to have a difference of opinion on exactly how readily available that is. Libby, why don't you start off? Where do you see those opportunities? How extensive are they?
I mean, I see opportunities in more progressive practices, such as better animal husbandry and welfare practices. I mean, we've seen a lot of negative publicity in the beef industry just with movies like Food Inc. or Omnivore's Development Dilemma. And I think that's caused problems for the beef industry from a consumer standpoint. So in terms of educating the consumer and marketing possibilities, I think promoting better husbandry, animal welfare practices using antibiotic-free, vegetarian-fed or grass-fed beef, also raising different breeds, whether it's leaner or heartier brands, Angus or Hereford, more quality brands, or it's selling direct to consumers through farmers markets, selling directly to specialty restaurants or retailers, creating cooperatives to create a better base from which to have
marketing power or creating value-added products in the organic and natural markets. In particular, there's just an explosion of consumer demand for value-added products. I talked with Mark McKay, the CEO of Coleman Natural Products down in Colorado, and he had recently met with a group of ranchers in Iowa, and they were using a local small packer to sell products and create value-added products that he then distributed to the natural foods industry, everything from flavored sausages to meatballs to, you know, I know I've seen organic jerky, beef jerky products, that type of thing.
So, Bill, I want to go to you on this one. We heard someone this morning say that the problem is if you want to sell directly to consumers, stores, restaurants, you've got to go through a USDA facility, and that may not be easily accessible. How do we bring the opportunities that Libby talked about and square that with that challenge that was talked about this morning?
It's not easy. And that's one of the big issues. But before we get too optimistic about these alternatives, may I just remind you that Laura's Lean Beef sold out to Meyer's All Natural Angus down at Loveland here. And that was in 08, I believe. And then Coleman sold out to the same organization. So Coleman All Natural went to Meyer's. And I think it's the beginning of this month, less than 30 days, that Meyer's All Natural Angus was basically, they called it a go-to-market effort with Cargill. But basically, all the processing and so on is going to be shifted over to Cargill. The bottom line is, once we do get these set up, and if they're successful, and I pick on these especially because these are such well-known brands. If there's any banner brands in the country, these are the three. And yet, basically, for all practical purposes, those producers who used to have a unique product, it will stay that way for a while, but the whole identity, the real benefits of some of these alternatives is being lost pretty rapidly when it gets put into a system like that. And as I said earlier, I was on the board of Ozark Mountain Pork. That's sort of an interesting one because after the price of hogs dropped at the end of the 90s, the USDA, the Rural Development Division, gave out a lot of grants to farmers who had hogs who were trying to put together an alternative market. And that meant including perhaps putting together a processing plant, to get back to the real question here. Interestingly, we got started. We had our problems along the line. But eventually, we got things sort of going. Now we had a pretty big debt in the meantime. And we were selling meat on the West Coast. We were out on the East Coast. We were into to a distributor with the high-end restaurants in the West or East Coast. We were into Whole Foods. And then Meadowbrook, there ended up being three cooperatives, three organizations working together on this because we had the farmers with us to raise the product to begin with, but it took so long to get the market. We didn't have a market. By the time we got the market, we no longer had many producers left in our organization. Meadowbrook had this nice facility, but they couldn't keep it busy. So we teamed up with Meadowbrook and another organization that had producers that needed a place to go. So we've sort of had three cooperatives working together cooperatively. That was a nice way to do it. Then Meadowbrook finally got in trouble and they went under. Those of you who followed the news in the last week, that facility just finally, it's been sitting empty since then. It got picked up by another one's going to try it. We have kind of saying in our group, we bought our processing plant after someone else went broke. And the saying around our board was, well, the first mouse doesn't get the cheese. The question is, will the second one get the cheese? So maybe now the second one, then we'll get it. But the bottom line, there's a processing plant, got set up, got going, couldn't make it. Before long, our other partner had some real financial issues given just the whole commodity issues and so on. They pulled out. We were going on our own. And one day, we got a call from journalists. There were three journalists that called, one from USDA, one from a farm magazine, one from a trade journal. And they wanted to suddenly know more about our organization. We have a sense maybe that we were the only ones. We know there weren't many. We think we may have been the last one standing of those people who got those USDA grants.
Well,
let me just add that. And before that day was over, I got a call from the president board of directors saying we were done. We were sold out. We're done.
So to another foreign metaphor, there could be said to be a chicken and egg problem here. If you don't have the processing facility, it's hard to have
opportunities get developed.
If you don't have the people selling, it's hard to make it work. Mark, you have a unique perspective on what it takes to make these facilities viable. What are your thoughts?
Bill brings up an excellent point about, you know, Laura's Lee and Meyer and the transition that's going there. The question to be asked is, why did they end up consolidating at the beginning levels and at the end? And here's the thing. So if we all closed our eyes and we waved a magic wand and we woke up tomorrow and a dream came true and under the current U.S. law, we busted up the big packers. So what would it look like? Well, the law says you have to divest. So somebody has to operate that facility. How long could an independent plant out there by itself in Marshalltown, Iowa, withstand the price pressures that are put on them by the large retailers like Walmart, squeezing every ounce of profit out of them? We end up, I think, with less in plants that sit empty because then they're no longer, you know, being divested. They just couldn't make it as a company, so they go out of business. Well, who gets hurt there? The producer has nobody to sell their stock to, and the worker has no place to work. The consumer gets less choice. Those communities are devastated by the loss of good jobs and community. So as we look at this, I don't want to sound like I'm beating this drum to death, but there is a large component that really needs to be addressed. Hopefully it gets addressed in Washington. These retailers are exercising way too much power in this industry, and somebody's got to call them on it, and they have to do it soon.
So I want to go to our panel and ask you, each member of the panel in a minute or so, to give their advice to a startup rancher who's getting into the business, to understand, obviously, the challenges we talked about. What kinds of counsel would you give them? Clem, why don't you start us off?
Well, I think someone said it earlier, you need to use all the tools available, but capital is a huge issue for young farmers, I think. Some of us who have some land know how much land has appreciated. For some of us, that's a wealth effect, and that's nice, but for a young farmer, that just is a tremendous obstacle to getting in the business. And so, you know, you're going to have to use enterprise budgets, you're going to have to use cash flow planning and every tool that's available to make sure you don't overinvest. The standardized production analysis data shows pretty clearly that the top quartile in profitability are those operations that have below average investments in land, equipment, and cattle, above average production. So you have to take care of the production end of the business, and you have to concentrate on marketing. And that means doing the things that the market suggests. And for example, we've been trying to push preconditioning programs in Oklahoma and many other parts of the Midwest because we think there's some premiums there that cow-calf producers can benefit from.
Gio?
The question is advice to a young start. What can they do? What that old's there? You know, if you're going to get married, she might as well be rich. I don't think someone could get started the way I got started and make a go of it. And part of it that helped me a lot, besides my parents, of course, was USDA and the Farmers Home Administration. Probably the best program USDA ever had. And after helping me with low loans and helping me on planning and business and advice and stuff, after about 13 years, they told me it was time to graduate, and I did. And I'm still here, but I can help my son quite a bit, but I don't think he'd be able to make a go of it unless he finds that rich girl.
Jerry?
I'd say get a good education, get some business experience. Maybe even you go away and work away from home for a year or two with somebody else. Work with your banker, establish that relationship. learn about risk management. We're in a risky business. Not enough of us understand how to manage risk, and I think they need to, as they come into the industry, they need to understand how to manage risk. Let's get rid of the estate tax. Make it easier for these people to come back to the farm and ranch. Let's lower the cost of regulation. Air regs, water regs, it's unbelievable what the cost of that is right now and the negative impact it has on agriculture. How are we going to repopulate rural America when we regulate them out of business? And finally, we've got to figure out how to make land cheaper. You know, we've got to quit letting land be developed for cities. Urban sprawl and recreation is ruining the opportunity for young people to buy land in all parts of the country.
Libby?
Well, coming from the small business perspective, I'm the consummate entrepreneur and always optimistic and always think that there's a way for business to compete. Small business owners need to be creative, need to have aggressive marketing strategies, and I do a lot of small business consulting, and I feel like, you know, just like any other small business, creating a niche and being creative, looking for opportunities where you might not think there are opportunities is the best way to succeed.
Mark?
Well, where I grew up, you either raised it or killed it. My family killed it. So my advice to anybody starting up in anything, I guess, would be join a union.
Actually, you know, from the swine sector, we have had some success with young beginning farmers getting in. I can give you countless stories of we did loans, young beginning farmer loans, and we have young beginning farmer programs where we were leveraged that the kid didn't hardly have a, what's the term, pot to piss in. But, you know, we developed young beginning farmer programs that had contract arrangements for with a contract pig owner. It's been paid off over a 10-year period. Now they've had the choice, and they have the choice, however, if they want to own pigs. Some of them are, and some of them have chosen to be still been under contract production. That program has been one of the best young beginning farmer programs that we have had in our association, bar none. And it has allowed, I can give you countless stories of farmers, these young guys in their mid-20s now that are actually owning some pigs, also owning some land, that have done pretty well. I'd give you one quick story. We had a college intern last year. He did a lot. He's a lot smarter than me, by the way. Family farm, 500 sows, fair to finish. He came in and he was helping us kind of analyze our portfolio. But I said, well, if you had a wish, what would you do? What did I want him to do? He put together a live break-even using the Chicago Board of Trade with futures live with corn, meal, and hogs, and I kind of helped him kind of do average cost. But he built it in about 2 days, and it's live. There is a ton of bright young people that have, and he went back home farming, by the way, but he's using that tool to manage his risk. So there is opportunities, by the way.
I agree. There are plenty of opportunities. I think it's a great question because young farmers, we're all vested in them. We need food. We need food production. So starting to think about this question, it was, what would I like to tell them or what do I need to tell them? I'd like to tell them, you know, it's a very profitable industry. They have to get in it. There's nothing else better. Great lifestyle, great communities, great and plentiful market options where they can make lots and lots of money. What I need to tell them is that they need to be efficient, because there's slim margins and any errors out there are going to quickly wipe those away. So a good education, understanding risk management, I think is very, very important. Also, you need to watch your cash flows. You need to see where that money's coming in and where that money's going out. Don't depend on a banker. I like the gentleman's idea about finding a rich spouse, you know, a wife or husband down there. I put down, you know, find a rich aunt or uncle and get the money, get the animals from mom and dad. The estate taxes are an issue, especially in rural America, but if you're going to pass on an estate and you're going to die, 2010 is the year. Just ask George Steinbrenner. And there's an adage that goes, if you want to make a little money farming, start off with a lot of money. It's very honorable to raise food for the American people and the world. I take a lot of pride in that, and I consider it a strong privilege to live in the lifestyle and the communities I do live in. There should not be a trade-off, though, to have that wonderful lifestyle and that honorable profession and trade that off for economic opportunity. We shouldn't have that trade-off. One final comment. I think we don't need to look just to our rural communities to develop young farmers. We need to look for flight from our urban and suburban neighbors. We're so much looking at how do we keep people on the farm. We need to keep them on the farm, but we also need to find how people are going to get into farming industries as well. So there's a lot of options, a lot of opportunity. We just need to develop the mechanisms and the infrastructure to do so for those young people.
And by the way, later today, Armando will be doing a stand-up comedy routine at Congressman Markey's ice cream shop for those who want to stop by.
How do you think I went through Colorado State University, you know?
Well, the question isn't exactly just hypothetical for me. About a year ago, I learned of a young fellow, a senior in the College of Ag, finishing up. He lived about 6-8 miles from me, and he wanted to farm. He's gotten an FSA loan and bought some cattle. There were a couple of landlords who rented him land at below what I would call market price that they could have rented for him, giving him a break. I'm trying to downsize, so I got a little more time to do things. I need somebody to help me in the wintertime and other times to look after my animals when I'm traveling. And so I've got machinery capacity for haymaking and so on that I don't use much anymore. And so I could help him out on that. So some sort of got together talking about this. But when you really get right down to it, he's either got to, as someone said earlier, market, really spend some time marketing. And people who do this tell me when they're producing, I think, Armando, you brought that up, you got to spend about half your time producing and half your time marketing when you do that.
And another half, you know, taking care of everything else, right?
Yeah, you do that after dark.
You need a good banker, though.
Well, and that's really the point. With all that going for him, are we really going to do him a service by putting this piece together? It's still a question.
So, Bill, you made a reference I want to say. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get to the comments, but this one we have to say, which is thank you to all the people who stayed home so we could be here today taking care of our cattle, livestock, and farms. We're aware a lot of people couldn't make it because they were helping those who came. We should acknowledge those people.